Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano, host and guide on the program. We're here and we talk about, among many other things, addiction and treatment and behavioral health in general, which is altogether appropriate because the folks who underwrite this are Retreat, and they are a renowned behavioral health facility, about which more a little bit later. So we hope you have some time. This show is dedicated to informing people about something which is obviously very, very much in the news, and that's both the dual issues of mental health issues, but how they impact the community with regard to the raging drug problem we are confronting ourselves within this country right now. It's an informational tool. That's what Recovery Radio is all about. It's to give you information about something, as I said, you may read a lot about, but there's still many, many myths and many, many misconceptions about what the disease of addiction is all about. So to that end, and during this month, which there's a lot of focus on both the treatment and recovery, as well as overdose awareness during the month of September, we have been focusing on that issue on the program. To that end, we're going to bring you our guest. We're real happy to have her here now. And while it may seem odd or counterintuitive, Jenny Merkin-Dedi's story does not end. Her story is formed by a tragedy. There's no other way to put that. But it does end on a very, very positive note. And that's the story we're going to tell you today about how this young lady had addiction descend upon her out of the blue, and the price they paid for that, and what they're doing to help other people in this regard. So that's what we got. We hope you stick around, and we got some information for you that might help other people. Jenny Merkin-Dedi, thanks for coming in, Jenny. Good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jenny and I were swapping reminiscences about places we know and have been to. She's a Long Island girl.
Yes, sir.
And I told her I didn't hear her accent, and I told her I was from Philadelphia. She said, well, I don't hear yours either. So we're flattering each other here on the program. So, Jenny, let's talk about your story.
Sure.
First of all, I know that, as I said, a tragedy is what shaped your life as we're going forward now.
Right.
And that has to do with the fact that you lost someone very, very dear to you. Tell us the story about this.
Yes. I met the love of my life, Sean Mahal, in 2016. And I knew very, very early on that he was the man that I was meant to spend the rest of my life with. So was very excited to embark on a relationship with him. And he truly was my best friend and the person that I knew would have I'd have a wonderful life with. And he, during the time that I was with him, he informed me that he struggled with alcohol. He did go to AA, so I was aware that he had a drinking problem and he abstained from alcohol. What I did not realize was he also really struggled with drug addiction. And I did not know that until it was way too late. And sorry, go ahead.
No. I want you to tell your story in your own words. I just want to know, where were you when you met? Were you at school? How old were you?
Oh my goodness. It was 2016. So I was, 32, 33 at the time.
Okay, so you weren't kids.
Yeah. Okay. We were adults, yes.
Yeah. And you start dating, and I'm sorry, now you continue the story. So you knew he was forthcoming about his alcohol.
Very, and in the very beginning, too.
Did you, right away.
Right away.
It's not that you noticed that he couldn't handle his alcohol, he just fessed up immediately.
No, he actually believed that was going to be a deal breaker for us.
So might as well get it out of the way.
Right. And of course, I told him that wouldn't be a problem. It made me think a little bit more about, how much alcohol I would ever consume in front of him. And of course, he had problems with that. He didn't want me to change anything about how I would operate in my daily, life. So, he was very forthcoming about that in the beginning, but he did not share with me the struggles that he had with drugs.
When you say it was forthcoming about the alcohol problem, was he in AA at that time?
He was.
How long? So he's sober when you meet him.
He
tells you that he's had a problem, but he's sober.
Yes. He actually, when we were together, that was the longest amount of time that he was sober. When he passed away, I had I had discovered that he had been drug-free and alcohol-free for over 2 years, and then discovered that that's the longest amount of time that he had gone without using since he was 13. It seems that he got introduced into all of that when he was at age 13.
Yeah. So at any point before he overdosed,
he did,
and passed away. Did you get more information then? That was all. Was that all of this after the fact?
Yes, everything was after the fact.
After the fact.
Yes.
So let me ask you a question now. We all understand about the bolt of lightning that hits people when and they just know that these are folks they want to be with. Do you look back now and think you were blind or willfully looking the other way, or was there simply no evidence that he had a deeper problem?
No, in hindsight, and trust me, I have spent a great deal of time trying to dissect and analyze every moment that I spent with him over our time together, and I was afraid. I was afraid to pose certain questions, and I was afraid to ask about his past because it was a very painful thing for him to talk about, and I allowed him to be open about what he wanted, but I didn't want to push. And I had never been in a relationship with someone who had ever had a drinking problem or any kind of, problem in that manner. So I was, it was new, it was fresh water for me, and I had no idea how to swim in it.
Yeah, well, no one goes looking for trouble. I mean, that would be, that's kind of understandable. I'm just trying, I only go down this road of talking to you because so many people say the same thing about I never saw it coming, and lots of other people go, really, come on.
Right.
So here you are, young girl, you're in love, there's no doubt about it. He tells you he has a drinking problem. He tells you he's been sober for a couple of years. He's very honest about that. He's going to the meetings. He's going to the rooms. But you have this sort of fear in the back of your mind that there might be something else going on.
Well, what really triggered it was around Christmas, which was essentially about 2 months before he passed, he began to talk at length about considering drinking again. And he did make the decision to start socially drinking about 5 weeks prior to his overdose. And I can't tell you how many times I've laid awake at night just thinking, what if I would have said something? What if I would have asked his family? What if I would have asked his friends, the ones that I knew were going to AA with him? And I never did those things.
Never did. Did he give you any specific reason why? Did he feel, okay, I'm doing all the steps, I'm cool, I can start drinking? Was that his attitude?
He sponsored many people in AA, and he began to feel a little overwhelmed with everything that he was doing. He had a great job. We were planning on buying a house. We wanted to get married. So there were a lot of things that were going on. And at many, many instances, he felt like, well, I could tell that he was definitely overwhelmed and he was stressed. And the one thing that he kept saying was he never envisioned being, sober from drinking his entire life. And that now that he had, got the job that he wanted, he had a relationship, he was moving forward, he felt like he could begin drinking again for social, for recreational time with friends.
Yeah, yeah. Did you try to dissuade him of that?
I kept asking him if he was sure. And anytime I would try and, just kind of play devil's advocate or bring up anything, he would get very defensive.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So you pulled back.
I did.
Yeah. What would you say your level of understanding about the disease of addiction or alcoholism in this case? Did you know a lot about it? Did you think you knew a lot about it?
No, not at all. I trusted Sean. I trusted Sean to be honest with me, to be as forthright with me then as he was in the very beginning, and to let me know if he was struggling or had a problem. And I just wish that I would have done more.
Absolutely. This trust, when you're trusting the person who has the disease, is probably, as you know now, one of the classic mistakes.
Right, exactly.
Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. In hindsight, which is, 2020, did his friends who also had going through AA with him? Did they ever say to you, "I wish we had known"? Did they see him start to drink again? What did were they doing anything?
So what's interesting is I, after Sean passed, I went through many stages of grief, and the one of them that I spent a great deal of time in was anger. And I was angry at myself. I was angry at his friends. I was angry at his family, because when this happened, and it completely took me by, I mean, shock, surprise, every word you can use to describe that, they all knew the path that he was going to take. And they, many of them had said to me, maybe in an effort to be comforting or what, and I certainly didn't take it at the time as that, but they said that Sean needed to make his mistakes and he needed to hit rock bottom before he could change his mind.
Yeah, I can see you being angry there, because while that may be the, a terrific motive for them, you also needed to know what was really going on.
Right.
Do I understand you to say that those friends and his family were aware that the problem was greater than just alcohol?
I don't want to include his family in that. They knew that, that Sean began to drink again, and they definitely were concerned. We didn't speak personally to each other
how
about
do you know,
it.
How do you know they were concerned? Did he tell you?
They told me after the fact.
After the fact. Yes. After the fact. But nobody said this is a mistake.
No.
He never said to you he was arguing with his folks over or his
no.
friends over this?
No.
Right. So he not only did a good job of masking the mistake he was making about trying to drink again, but he never gave you the indication he was ever doing anything harder than that.
No.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, a lot of people are going to be surprised by what you turned all this into, because on the one hand, people go, that poor girl was not served well by a lot of people. But you've picked up this thing and done something extraordinary with it, and we'll find out all about that straight ahead. Jenny Murr Candetti is our guest. She's telling us her journey through the disease of addiction and how she's come out on the other side helping people. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. We have more.
Hello, everybody. It's the Street Certified Dope Doctor, Louis Delgado from The Couch Live. The Couch Live airs right here on the Problem Solving Network, WPSN99.com, each and every Friday live at noon, and replays here each and every day at 12 and 4 p.m. We focus on addiction, recovery, and all things in between, silencing the stigma since 1999. You know, in a time right now where there's so many of our friends and family members suffering with addiction and struggling with trying to get sober, we need a place to go to. We need a trustworthy place to help people not only talk about addiction and recovery in a non-threatening way, but also help guide people to get the help, good help. So join us on The Couch Live on the Problem Solving Network, WPSN99.com.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Our guest in the studio is Jenny Murr Candetti. She is with us to discuss 1 year in her life, actually, that changed her life dramatically. She met a guy. They fell in love. He was forthcoming in telling her about problems he'd had in the past with alcoholism that he now had under control. And as they planned for the future, they were going to get married. They were in love. He began socially drinking again. Jenny, during that period of time, were there any signals that maybe this was a bad idea, that he shouldn't be drinking?
Yeah, when he first started drinking again on his 34th birthday, which was December 27th. So that's just about a little over five weeks prior to his overdose. And just after his birthday, friends of ours, we organized a trip and we went to the Finger Lakes. And this is something that Sean and I never got to do before. So we were very excited and it was a fun weekend. And we visited wineries and got to drink wine and beer and really had an amazing time. Except during that trip, there were some moments that were a little scary for me. And he had gotten intoxicated and tried to cut him some slack because this was, you know, our first trip together and his first opportunity in many years to actually enjoy drinking some wine and being with friends. But yeah, during that trip in particular, that's when the concern started to grow. And then over the next few weeks, there was at least one more incident where I became very concerned. And then and then unfortunately he met his end very shortly thereafter.
Shortly thereafter that, during this period when the red flags are obvious, did you share this with anybody, any of his friends or your friends? Did you go, look, I'm worried about this?
Not his friends in particular. I didn't get to see them very often, but I had a few close friends and, my brother was on the trip with us and there were a few times that I mentioned my concern and everyone was like, you know what? It's okay. It'll be okay. He loves you. He'll listen to you. If you share with him your concern, he'll follow suit.
You know, it sounds like you may have been surrounded by people who sincerely believed that you were the best thing that ever happened to Sean.
Yes, people have said that, actually.
Right?
Yeah.
And so let's not burden her with a lot of scare stuff because we're convinced the hole in his life will be filled by her and their relationship. Is that what was going on?
I believe so, yes.
Well, you know what? Again, there's so many mistakes people make when confronted with the disease of addiction because, again, nobody plans for it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody says, well, okay, I met a guy. What happens? What if he's an addict?
Right.
No one has that in their playbook.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Take us through the remaining months you guys are together. What happens next?
Sure. So it wasn't very long after that. And he had demonstrated that he was, again, feeling very stressed out. We knew that year we were going to be making a lot of changes, moving in together, buying a home. His friends had shared with me that Sean had planned to propose to me later that year. And, he had a lot on his mind, a lot on his plate. And I do believe that the drinking may have helped him to, kind of deal with that stress. But ultimately, all it did was make him crave even more the drugs. And based on what I have been able to find out, in the week leading up to his death, he began contacting people that he knew he could potentially purchase drugs from. The person that he did ultimately end up purchasing drugs from was someone he knew. It was a friend of his. It was someone he worked with. And what ended up happening was I think he felt like, if I'm going to do this, let me go big or go home. Mm-hmm. So when he did overdose, autopsy results showed that it was a combination of pills. It was a combination of cocaine and heroin and fentanyl. As well,
during this year, with the exception of the incidents where you saw that he had drunk too much,
mm-hmm.
was he using all those substances as well?
No, he was not. And to the best of my knowledge, I have to say no, because we looked into his computer, we looked into his cell phone, and we can only really pinpoint that it happened in the days leading up to his death.
Well, so then in that regard, everybody else who was sort of, I don't want to use this pejoratively, keeping a secret about his background, they were equally shocked that he was this heavy into substances.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, one of the tragedies of the overdose, the spike in overdoses, is that lots of people who have had a problem with opioids and then pick it back up again, is that they're picking up stuff that's fentanyl will kill you.
Right.
Yeah, which sounds like a big contributing factor here.
Right.
Who found Sean?
I did.
What were the circumstances?
Well, that evening we had gone out with friends to celebrate their engagement. I went to a really wonderful dinner, and his behavior during the dinner was quite concerning. It had seemed like he had been drinking all day, and he was noticeably intoxicated over dinner, and he was behaving in a bit of a possessive manner. I remember running into a friend at the restaurant, and while talking with them, he came over and was like, what are you doing? Let's go back to the table. And that was very unlike him. So after dinner, we returned to my home. We hosted everyone at my home. And he again just began to, he was acting like he was drunk. So I was furious. And the next day was Super Bowl Sunday, and we were planning to go to a party. So we needed to go to the grocery store to buy some food to prepare to bring to the party. It was after 11 o'clock at night, and everyone had left. And, He pulled me aside and he apologized for the way he had been behaving. And he told me that he loved me. And I was so angry at him that I did not say it back. And I said, I'm going to go to the grocery store. And when I come back, we're going to deal with this. And in my mind, I thought, he'll be asleep by then. We're going to talk about this big time tomorrow morning. And we're going to lay some things out on the table. And when I returned from the grocery store, which I swear couldn't have been more than 30 minutes later, I came home. He was in the restroom and I could not get in. So I forced myself in and that's where I found him.
How old was he?
34.
34 years old. How long ago did the overdose happen?
February 5th, 2017.
Jenny Mercandetti is our guest telling us how the disease of addiction landed like a gigantic weight on her life in the 1 year she was in love and engaged, more or less, to a young man who, as she just told us, overdoses from his use of very serious drugs. What happened as a result of that is where we'll pick up her story straight ahead. Recovery Radio, don't go away.
Hey, hey, it's the Dharma Guy. You might recognize me from The Couch Live. I have my new show called Dharma Time. It airs on Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and again at 5 p.m. I focus on the spiritual side of life and how to use it to achieve long-lasting happiness and enlightenment. So tune in Tuesdays, 1 or 5 p.m. Eastern. Dharma Time.
Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We're going to return to our guest's story straight ahead. But I want to remind you that the freight for the program, the underwriting, as it were, is provided by our great, great partners, Retreat Behavioral Health. And I want to give you their phone number every opportunity I have. I want to give you their phone number. And I always do it in the absolute sincere desire that you never have to use it. And I know Peter Shure, who's the CEO and founder of Retreat, says the same thing. Give them the phone number. We'll give them answers. We'll give them help if we can, but we'll give them answers and tell them we hope they never have to use the phone number. But I think you can tell from our guest today and other guests we've had on the program, and maybe your own experience, is that no one sees addiction coming. They're never ready for it. It blindsides almost everyone. And in those moments of extreme pressure and confusion and fear and everything else, you don't know where to turn. I'll give you the phone number of Retreat. I assure you, they will give you answers to your questions. 855-859-8808. Retreat Behavioral Health. 855-859-8808. One of those people that was really blindsided by the disease of addiction is Jenny Mercandetti. She's our guest in the studio talking about a fellow she met. They had a whirlwind relationship, and in a year, he managed to do two things. Hide his serious history of substance abuse and overdose and die at the age of 34. So, Jenny, by the way, was it obvious when you saw him in the bathroom, was it? Did he use IV? Was he?
So I did not see that. I saw a very tall glass of water, and I actually didn't have any idea what happened.
So I only asked it because that's not the first moment when you go, oh my God, he was doing other substances. When and how did you fill in that backstory about his history of serious substance abuse?
Right. So. When this was all happening in my home and the paramedics were informing me what was happening, I truly felt like this was surreal and it was not happening because the Sean I knew would never have used heroin, would never have used drugs. They were telling me that they were using Narcan to try and bring him back to life. And at that time, I didn't really know what Narcan was. I had a general idea, but I didn't know. So I can tell you that those moments were a bit of a blur. But in the days and the weeks following his passing, I wanted to honor him. So we planned a funeral. in his hometown of Wilkes-Barre. But then I kind of planned my own special thing in Lancaster so that his friends, those particularly in the recovery community, could be a part of it. So we hosted a celebration of life for him about a month after he passed away. And in the planning of that, I met with some of his very close friends who also were in AA. And it was, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, it was then that I realized that his friends in AA, I thought they were alcoholics, but his friends are heroin addicts. And they went to AA because they believed that AA was a little bit more suitable for them than NA.
Right.
So this whole time, all of his friends that I knew and I had met from AA, I thought they had drinking problems. And then I came to learn that it was much bigger.
From them? They ultimately... Well, were they mostly men?
Yes.
Did they have women in their lives?
Two of them are married and the others were single.
Were those women at that time with those people aware of their background?
Yes, those folks were, yes.
Yeah, you were the only one that didn't know what was really going on.
Right.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I think most people thought that Sean had shared that with me.
Yeah, and why bring it up?
Right.
Did you have to tell his parents that he died?
I had to receive a phone call because they were kind enough to send a policeman to the door. So they found out in person from a police officer in Wilkes-Barre and then the phone call afterwards. I did my best. My family sort of helped me with
that. What was Sean's family life like? Does he have brothers and sisters?
He has a younger brother. They're just the younger brother and very close with his mother. I mean, used to talk with her daily. His mother and father were divorced. And, you know, one of the reasons that Sean came to Lancaster was because Wilkes-Barre did not represent a lot of great things for Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And
Of his background? You mean because of what he'd been through?
Yes.
So he was trying to change the places.
Exactly right.
Yeah. All right. At what point did everybody start to open up about this? It was during the celebration of his life that you started?
It was, when his family came to Lancaster, they weren't able to come right away. So they came about a week after he passed away, and they spent the day with me. And we went to his home, and they went through his things. And at that point, it was his family and his roommate. He had a roommate, great guy. Each one of them has their own story, but they shared a similarity in their battles. So it was from his roommate and his family that I began to really learn more and to understand that this all started when he was a teenager. And I knew he had served time in jail, but I didn't understand the circumstances behind the reasoning for going to jail. And I came to understand that it was drug related.
Mm-hmm.
And that that Sean had been his longest time sober when I was with him.
When he was with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, which ironically is probably what his friends were trying to maintain rather than dragging the past into this.
Right.
Turned out to be a dangerous strategy. Among the things you learned, had Sean had a history of overdose during the periods before you knew him? Do you know?
Not overdose. Drug use, though. Yes, definitely. And
opioid
yes,
drug use.
Yes. It's funny. Someone in particular who was very close to him reached out to me and shared with me her stories. And she was the one who bluntly put that he was a heroin addict. And to actually read those words in a message, that ripped me apart. And then, of course, I couldn't understand how I was not aware of it. And I even became angry with him because he didn't share that with me. And
Jenny, no one listening to this story could be confused at all by your attitude of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly even when people are aware of the problem, when a death occurs, they blame themselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't do enough. I should have been more vigilant. You weren't armed with anywhere near the information that you needed. So I understand your anger. So when that first bolt hit you, he is a longstanding, I mean, it would have been 20 years, right, of
right.
a drug problem.
Yes.
By the time you met him.
Right.
And you're just finding this out after he passed away. You must have been furious with everybody, everything.
Yes, I really was. But ultimately, I would say the person I took it out on the most was myself.
Yeah.
And
that this whole story leads to the remarkable fact that you don't walk away from this and just go, oh, my God, this is the most horrible thing that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. And boy, if I had only known, you don't do any of that. Why did you form this foundation in his memory?
Sean was, even though I only was with him for, you know, a fraction of my lifetime, truly a fraction, he changed my life. And he was meant for so many more great things than what he was able to accomplish. And I can't stand the fact of thinking that Sean is just merely one of a million overdoses that takes place as a result of this current crisis, and that Sean gets thrown into, you know, I want him to be remembered. I want people to know him for more than just being an overdose statistic. He helped countless people. And when he passed away, I can't tell you the number of messages I received from strangers that said that if it weren't for Sean, I would have died. I would have overdosed.
It's extraordinary that you would have done this. I mean, quite apart from the horrors of substance abuse and death, what you had here is a story that a lot of women, a lot of men and women have had, mm-hmm. and that is a relationship that you started out one way and took a terrible turn for the worse. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it's a small portion of your life, a tiny portion of your life. In those other situations, people just go, well, that was bad. I thought I loved them. I thought we were going to be forever, and we're not. Now I'm moving on. You moved on, but in a profoundly important way, I think. So you formed this foundation. Tell us about the idea for the foundation.
Yeah, so we call it the Mighty Mahal Foundation after Sean, and it really is to honor what I believe is his legacy. And his legacy was helping people and helping them to understand that their life does not have to be defined by their addiction. So our foundation does provide scholarships to men and women who are seeking residence in a recovery or a sober living house in Lancaster County. And Lancaster in particular is very special because Sean did consider this his home, and he moved to Lancaster specifically to get into the recovery community. So our foundation's mission is to help those who don't have the financial means to get into a recovery house.
Do you think Sean was let down in a sense by what was available to him that you're trying to fill? I mean, had he been in sober living facilities?
He had, and that's how he got to Lancaster. So, yeah. I do believe that the resources that are available here in Lancaster are what extended his life. If he would have stayed in Wilkes-Barre, he probably would not have made it.
Died before you met him.
Right.
Yeah. I was about to say, did he... And his friends, what were the I want to pick up on this in the next segment, because there are a lot of people, as you know, who've just heard your story and are, on the one hand, sympathetic with you. This is a horrible thing to have mm-hmm. happened to this young lady, but are probably equally confused about, well, wait a minute, what's going on here now? Mm-hmm. Why not just move on?
Right.
Well, that was a terrible event. I'm young. I'm attractive. I've got my life. Why not move on? You did move on, but in a very significant way with this foundation. Jenny Mercandetti is our guest. An extraordinary story of the disease of addiction, the death of someone she characterizes now as the love of her life, and the foundation in his memory that grew out of that. Recovery Radio, we have more straight ahead. Don't go away.
Jojo Knows.
And Constance B.
And we are back with a fabulous show, The Lemon Squeeze.
Woo!
So tune in Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. daily. Monday through Friday daily. No weekend.
Exactly. And make sure you tune in to WPSN99.com.
Also follow us on Instagram, Lemon Squeeze Show.
Yes, and we do follow back.
We do?
We do.
We
do.
Follow back. See you on the air.
Bye.
back here on Recovery Radio. We want to really thank Jenny Mercandetti for telling us this extraordinary story of this horrible, horrible event in her life, which she has turned into something very, very positive. The Mighty Mahal Foundation is in the memory of the love of her life. Sean passed away of a drug overdose, and in his memory, Jenny's foundation now tries to help guys. You talked about scholarships. I do want to make one point about that. For people who don't know what you're, what do you mean by you pay for people to go to these places?
Correct. Yes. So for folks who are, you know, coming out of a out of treatment or who are coming out of jail or who are just simply looking to get help and reside in a house, in a recovery house, so many people do not have insurance. So many people have already used their one opportunity to get help from the state. So what we do is we provide the financial assistance to pay for their entry fees. And, you know, each house is a little bit different on their rental fees, but it at least gets them started and gets them a foot in the door.
Let's talk about the reaction to what you chose to do in the face of this tragedy. As we said in the last segment, it would have been very easy for you and certainly understandable for anybody listening to just go, well, that was a horrible event in my life, but I'm moving on. Were you told by other people when you started thinking about this foundation that, that maybe this was not the best thing you should be doing?
Yeah, actually, what's funny is I started to see a therapist after Sean's passing, and that was the cautious advice from my own therapist, in addition to close friends and family. And, you know, of course, people are supportive, but they also are concerned for you. They think that if you're going to focus on something that just brings that tragedy to the forefront daily, they're a little concerned for you. And I understand that. In particular, there were some folks who really thought that this would not be a healthy avenue to take, and that I should maybe focus on other things to distract myself and try and move on. But this was so important to me because I do not want Sean's life and everything that he went through to be for nothing. And if we can help one person, that's one person who doesn't have to go through what I went through or what Sean's family went through. And that's just so important to me.
I forget. Did you tell us how you two met? Where it happened specifically?
No, we actually met online.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Which is funny because he was so embarrassed about that. So
people got to stop doing that, because I'll tell you, I tell younger people than I who are sheepish about it. I go, look, you go to a bar. Mm-hmm. There's 250 people in the room. Maybe there are three that you might be interested in. You go online, there's thousands.
Right, exactly.
All it does is increase the odds. So he had this profound impact on you. And you say it's not just you who had stars in your eyes. He had lots of friends and people who loved him and spoke warmly of him. And yet folks are going, look, she's just doing this to cope. And it's not a good idea. Were your parents similarly inclined to say maybe this isn't a good idea?
Yeah. They were never as vocal about it as some of my closer friends were and my siblings. They wanted me to heal. And I think they wanted to be supportive and they didn't want to upset me. Nobody wanted to upset me. But especially to see how much the foundation has grown in such a short amount of time, everybody equally feels that this was a really great choice to make.
I'm guessing that you didn't have a lot of experience in forming a foundation.
Oh, no, not at all.
We've had lots of folks who similarly started foundations in the memory of people they have lost. And I always ask them the same question. How'd you do that? How does somebody start a foundation?
Yeah, I actually got together with some of Sean's really good friends who are in recovery as well. And they were the ones who really thought that it would be a great idea to honor Sean in a way of helping others who have been down the same road that they have been, including Sean. I really wanted to do something, but I didn't quite know how to really leave Sean's legacy. And this was perfect. And his friends, really the ones who, you know, who have been sober for many years, they're the ones who I leaned on and they encouraged me, and they still are huge supporters of our foundation. And I have to say that without them, we would never have, I would never have taken the steps to, you know, get the foundation started and get all the paperwork signed.
Was there a period of time when you had to forgive them and actually embrace them so they could help you do this? There
yeah.
was a, there must have been a time when you went, I don't want anything to do with this, these people.
Yeah, it was early on. I was, you know, again, just really battling through that anger stage. But I don't know. It was, I have to say, one of them in particular did bring me to an Al-Anon meeting, which was very uncomfortable for me because mm-hmm. in an Al-Anon meeting, everyone's loved ones are alive, and I was the only one who was there where mine was dead.
Mm-hmm.
But in hearing other people's stories and in hearing how people's lives had been affected by Sean when he was alive, that's what really drove me and motivated me to continue.
And I you're another example of the fact of how helpful it is to let go of the baggage of recrimination and anger in order to get anything done. I mean, that's part of the process, isn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely. Forgiving everybody, including Sean.
Absolutely.
Jenny, it's a remarkable story. As I said, lots of people in your situation would have walked away from this and never looked back. You didn't do that. And the Mighty Mahal Foundation is testament to that. If people want more information in our area or anywhere, because, you know, you can hear this show anywhere, what do they need to do?
Sure. You can go right to our website, which is www.mightymahal.org. And we have lots of information there. And they can also reach out to me personally by email or by my cell phone.
Terrific. We remind people that she's a 501c, which means she relies upon the generosity of good people who are strangers. Jenny, thanks so much. I know we're going to have a couple of people that have done work with you with regard to the foundation. We're also from this area straight ahead. A couple of interesting guys that are, believe it or not, using skateboards to help people.
Right.
It's a remarkable story there as well. We thank you so much, and great success with the foundation straight ahead.
No, thank you so much, and thank you for letting me share my story with others. I really appreciate it.
Jenny Mercandetti, thank you all for your time. Recovery Radio, we'll be back at you. Bye-bye.